on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
We were showing other coma survivors who perhaps never spoken to anyone about their stories, just what others go through, that they are not alone, that whatever they experience is not a sign of madness. They have not got a mental illness, which they may have been diagnosed with, that what they've experienced, in many cases, people have been experiencing since the dawn of time. When a mystic goes into the deepest recesses of a cave to cut themselves off from the physical world to commune with the spirit world, the things that they are seeking, many a time, are the things coma survivors are reporting. These, you know, the out-of-body experiences, the beautiful countryside and things, the meeting of entities and all these different things, these are being reported within coma. Because we live in a materialistic science world where if you can't weigh it, measure it, you know, slice it up or whatever, it does not exist. Therefore, when a doctor cannot explain to a patient the level of consciousness they're experiencing at this very minute, they haven't got a hope of explaining the level of consciousness that people are experiencing deep within coma.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by Alan Pierce, co-author with his wife, Beverly, of the book Coma and Near-Death Experience, The Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious. Alan discusses how patients placed in medically induced comas experience alternate realities and the negative effects experienced by patients, including delirium and PTSD, significant drops in IQ, and why this medical practice must change. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Alan Pierce is a journalist, broadcaster, former BBC correspondent, and author of several books. He has contributed to numerous publications from Time magazine to the Sunday Times of London. Beverly Pierce is a former private investigator who now works as an aromatherapist and a practitioner in yoga-based bodywork. Alan joins me today to discuss their recently published book, Coma and Near-Death Experience, The Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious. Alan, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Hey, Nick, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I am very happy that you're here. I noted to you yesterday that I finished reading your book just the day before, and it was a fascinating read. It wasn't quite what I expected. It went beyond my expectations, I think, put it that way. And I found it at times to be a little bit unnerving as well. So all of that to say, I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. I thought I would ask to begin with, because it's never quite explicitly stated in the book, what was your interest that led you and Beverly to write this book?
Yeah, COVID lockdown, I think specifically. Hmm. Here we are, you know, being my wife, a private investigator, I'm a journalist. And we're both doing very little at the early stages of COVID. And I think like a lot of people, we were watching the TV news more than most. And I'm just wondering why so many people with COVID are being placed into medically induced comas. I just wanted to know, how does that work? It must be a wonderful thing. So I just wanted to find out. So I got up, spoke to Google, as it were, asked the question. And I was told that prolonged deep sedation within intensive care, which is how they often like to describe it, is an essential tool in critical care and has been for the past 50 years. It provides a deep restorative form of sleep that allows nature and the meds to do their job. It gives the patient a fighting chance. That's what Google says. That's what most doctors and nurses will tell you. Long story short, I found out that everything they tell you about coma is wrong. One of the main things they tell you about coma is that the event itself should be a complete blank in your lives. Despite the fact that they're always calling coma sleep, even the word coma is derived from an ancient Greek word meaning deep sleep. So they must be dreaming, you would think. Well, you're not actually dreaming because your mind brain is effectively flatlining on an EEG brain scanner, and yet your mind is incredibly active. So within a very short period of time, I realized that the official story had some kind of holes in it, and I started tracking down coma survivors. And then they were telling me the most remarkable things. It took a while to get people to tell me things. And I was kindly invited to sit in, as it were, on the Facebook coma survivors group. And I could watch what people were posting. And I was just amazed, because this so-called blank in their lives, for the vast majority, it was nightmarish events, sometimes the hospital weaving itself into another reality where the kind doctors and nurses are torturing them and so forth. Other times, people were having the what you would call the classic near-death experience, you know, beautiful bucolic countryside, you know, meeting dead relatives, stairway to heaven, that kind of thing. That crops up a lot. Others were having nightmarish events, so ghastly, so off the scale, that I don't think the human imagination could really come up with these things that they were telling me. And then yet more, we're talking of alternate lives, as in some cases, people having lives spanning decades, just like a regular life, you know, with all the usual trappings, you know, holding down jobs, getting married, going on vacation, having kids. And I mean, just completely real. And when somebody tells you of a near-death experience, they invariably say things like, it was more real than reality. Well, that's what everybody within coma is telling me. Everything is so real. So when they get a medical explanation, if they ever get one, and it will be something along the lines of, oh, that's a false memory, or you were hallucinating, or that was delirium, it drives them crazy. It's like they've been on holiday to New Zealand and come back, and everyone says, no, that's a false memory. You've just hallucinated. You've not been to New Zealand. You know, you doubt everyone's sanity, but people are left to doubt their own. And so suddenly these things are just gelling, and I hadn't thought to write a book at all. But as I gradually got to know coma survivors, and I had a lot of time on my hands, I realized I was onto something truly remarkable. And it boils down to a global medical disaster that ultimately is killing hundreds of thousands of people, has done over the years. It's leaving the survivors to live half lives. And people are visiting realms that I don't believe anybody's ever visited before. It's as if coma is opening a doorway to other levels of existence, other realities, other dimensions that people have never explored before. Over to you, Nick.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot there. And that's one of the reasons why the book was so absolutely fascinating. And you begin the book with this story of someone who had lived one of these other lives. And, you know, it was a little bit of a trick, I think, because, you know, it's like, oh, I think his name was Nick, actually, that, you know, he lived in this town, had this experience. I think he was married with a kid. And then, oh, but that's not real. This is what's real. And, you know, that really sort of shook me, the fact that these people are having these alternative lives. And what's so scary is what you had mentioned is that for them, the memories are real.
Oh, it's beyond real. You see, you take Nick's case. You know, here was Nick, 35-year-old, really good-looking guy, well-built, having a really quite nice life. He's running his own pizza parlor, owns and operates his own pizza parlor, and contracts pneumonia. And this is quickly turning to sepsis, which can lead to organ failure. Hospital take one look at him and do what they normally do in a circumstance like this, which is place him into a medically induced coma. He was down for 2 weeks. During that time, Nick experienced an alternate life spanning the 1960s and the 1970s. And everything about it was as real as this world, except he would say it's like the United States, but not the United States on a map. The same places were there, but they were in the wrong place. And he described the atmosphere as being slightly orange, whereas ours is somewhat blue. Within his time, he got called up to serve in the army in an alternate Southeast Asian war. And when you talk to him about his time there, his combat tour there, The thing that strikes him most is that his fingers and toes were constantly wrinkly from the wet that they never ever dried out. He's got that level of, experience of things, and that's the sort of thing that would stick in someone's mind, and it stuck in his. And he moves on, he's out of the army, he has a succession of jobs, he moves to a small town in the American Midwest, settles down, meets a girl, they have a baby girl. Soon after, their relationship breaks down. He's not caring for himself. I think he possibly has a heart attack. Next time he opens his eyes, he's in a hospital ward, and there's all these people, and they are overthrilled to see him back. And he doesn't know who the heck these people are. I guess they're calling him Nick, and he doesn't even know who Nick is. And there's this very attractive woman at his bedside holding his hand, claiming to be his fiancée, and he hasn't got the first clue who she is. And he's wondering, where's my partner? Where's my little girl? And here's the thing. He, in time, will accept that that was an event from within coma, not that he can understand it, but he can't really remember his past life in the same way that we remember our past life. And he's almost having to pretend to be the Nick that people expect him to be, because he's a very different Nick. The one in the coma was brilliant with his hands. He worked outside. He lost toes to frostbite. This Nick, the pizza parlor Nick, and he wouldn't even know how to change a light bulb. And yeah, here's another strange thing. The pizza parlor Nick now in this world, having come back from that world, has brought back with him a whole range of mechanical and electrical skills that he never had before. He can't just automatically do something, but he can turn his hand to it and find it remarkably easy to do those things. That's one example of an alternate life. Others can be really, really strange. I mean, well, that's not strange. One person told me she spent 100,000 years on the bottom and top levels of existence. On the bottom level, it was all mud and funny creatures, and on the top, it was all ones and zeros, and that she flitted between the two. People are recounting the most remarkable events within coma. When you look at the things that they are experiencing, you will find parallels elsewhere, such as the near-death experience. Nowhere can I find an example where someone's been living this life, taken a pause from it for, say, a fortnight, gone off, had 20 plus years somewhere else, a complete other life, and then come back and resumed this one. That's just unparalleled anywhere. And it is the sort of thing that people within coma, when you can get them to talk, will tell you about. And I spoke to others who are not in the book who wanted to talk about having a family in this other world, and they just couldn't bring themselves to do so because they're just breaking down. The emotions, the love, and the loss that they're left with. And the hospital, no way of dealing with this. So if you do ever talk to someone afterwards, as I was saying before, they just think it's a false memory, effectively a form of mental illness, and you're left on your own. And mostly, no one even gets any form of explanation. And they just think they have gone mad. They themselves have had a unique experience, which means they've lost their mind. Whoa.
Right. Yeah, the term is that they have a delirium, that
Oh,
somehow
yeah.
it's all false. But what was also fascinating is that these experiences were so real to them that when they came out of the coma, many of them were suffering from PTSD.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just being in intensive care for a period, something like 80% of people come out of that with post-traumatic stress disorder. When people come out of coma and they eventually speak to someone down the line and they try to talk about whatever's happened to them as best they can, often because of the symptoms, the flashbacks, the inability, they're not wanting to leave the home, all these different elements that add up to post-traumatic stress disorder. They're given whatever the current medication is for that. And it's okay. I mean, why are they getting PTSD? They're getting PTSD because they've seen and experienced horrendous events within their coma. The clinicians, however, are convinced they've got their PTSD because intensive care is quite a traumatic environment. Therefore, here's the irony, to avoid that traumatic environment, they knock them unconscious. But they're then putting them into these nightmarish worlds. But they don't know that. And when they try and bring somebody out of a medically induced coma, it's not like in a movie where they're going to wake up and drink coffee and say, "Hi, well, what year is this?" It's not like that. First of all, they don't even know who they are. One person told me she didn't even know what humans were, and there's no one they can relate to. I'm going off on a tangent here because, just trying to put myself in the mind again of how these people feel, how Nick would explain to himself what he's seen. When he talks to a doctor, they're saying, "Yes, it's PTSD." "Oh yeah, so I was going to say, so they're bringing you out of a coma." And in many cases, people are fighting and they're thrashing. And what they're trying to do is realizing perhaps that they're in this world and they want to hang on to this world and they want to grasp anything they can of this world. And that involves pulling all the tubes out of their body, their faces. There's blood going everywhere. Sometimes they're biting people. The nurse's instant reaction is to put them back down again. So once more, right, they're trapped into this world. And one nurse described it to me, bringing someone around from a medically induced coma. It's like for the ward, the nurses on the ward, it's like passing a hand grenade with a pin pulled out from shift to shift, because sooner or later, someone's going to have to let go of that handle and it's going to go bing. And no one wants to be that person. So they just keep knocking them out. And that's why so many people spend much longer than they ever should do, even if they shouldn't be in the coma in the first place, so much longer in one because they can't bring them out of it comfortably.
When I was reading the book, I'm currently living with my best friend, and I don't remember how far I was into it, but I made a point of telling her, please make sure that I am never placed in a medically induced coma.
Oh, if I were younger, I think I'd have it tattooed on my chest. No coma, no sedation. I would definitely go for that. And if I thought any of my loved ones or anyone I didn't even like for that matter was going to be placed into one, I would argue the case. And I would say this, this statistically, this can happen to any one of us. If we live in the Western world, the developed world, we've got 2 to 3 chances of being in intensive care in our lives. I've actually been in once, so maybe I've got one or two more to go. Under the current way of thinking, they will invariably deeply sedate you. Part of the reason is financial, because there's a shortage of staff, etc., etc., and they think it's expedient, the way to go. They will sedate you. So if it's likely to happen to absolutely any one of us. So if you're listening and suddenly it starts happening to one of your friends or family and they say we need to put them into a coma, say, okay, but can you provide any evidence explaining why this is a good thing? Because actually they can't. Now, we explore this on every level. I mean, well, be as a private investigator. If she can't find something, it's fair to say it doesn't exist. We spoke to the editors of the medical journal, The Lancet, and we said, "Can you point us to any articles you've published advocating prolonged deep sedation in intensive care?" Took them a few days, came back to us and says, "Hey, no, we haven't published any." And you think, well, that doesn't make sense because it's standard medical procedure. They said, "Look, you're more than welcome to have access to our archives." And we plowed through the archives. There's nothing in there. These people saying, "Yes, we do this." People saying it provides the deepest form of sleep without backing that up. And I might as well just mention this. It's called sleep. Time now for a nice sleep. Your husband is sleeping deeply. When you switch the brain off, it hasn't got the luxury of going through its circadian rhythms. If it's not doing that, you're not going into REM sleep. Therefore, you're not dreaming. If you're denied REM sleep for 3 days on average, you will begin to lose your mind. It's used universally as a form of torture. The medical world, scientific world, can't experiment on people over dangerously long periods without sleep. This is not ethical. The military, however, don't have any such qualms. And in certain prisons, such as Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib, they used to run a thing called the frequent flyer program, where they would keep prisoners awake for 3 weeks at a time. Subsequently, fast forward, a lot of these have come to court, and it's been determined in court that The practice of keeping them awake for 3 weeks has seriously permanently damaged their brain. And that, if it's proven to be done intentionally, it is therefore torture. But this is what every doctor and nurse is doing as we speak now around the world in intensive care units. And yet they're doing it with the best will in the world. And it's thanks to COVID, because so many people were placed into medically induced comas around the world, that you can see the damage because there's just so much more of it.
Right.
And since then, a lot of people have been exploring this, and a lot of brilliant work has been done in the last few years. And they've determined very, very clearly that not only is coma massively overused, it's almost used as the first option in so many cases. You know, I think doctors and nurses can agree, and the medical literature does agree, that there are a handful of instances where a person can be placed into a medically induced coma. Somebody having a brain seizure, wanting to prevent permanent damage to the brain, switch it off. But you're not switching it off for more than a few minutes, certainly not switching off for days, weeks, or months at a time as you are in coma. Certain kinds of injuries, such as abdominal, where you don't want people moving around, again, you might do that, but not for a long period. And if somebody's got particular kinds of complications after heart surgery and they need that oxygen, all the oxygen to get to the heart, the brain uses a lot of oxygen, they will switch the brain off or slow it down. But again, not for too long. Whenever they do switch it off for a lengthy period, it is beginning to cause damage in one form or another. Just the lack of sleep, you build up to 3 days and you're really into trouble. Additionally, there's the whole thing that whilst you're in a coma, you're not moving. Somebody is turning you every 2 hours to prevent bed sores, etc. But during that period, your body is wasting away. All sorts of terrible things happen. Joints calcify, nerves disconnect. You've got terrible skeletal damage. Muscle wastage is beyond shocking. For centuries, thousands of years, people have believed that bed rest, you're not well, go to bed, is one of the best things you can do. Turns out that it's one of the worst things you can do. Just 1 week of bed rest, i.e. not getting up, doing anything, 1 week of bed rest can result in the loss of 40% of lean muscle. That's a mighty amount of muscle. If you were in a coma for 3 months, say, you're not going to see this muscle wastage because you're so pumped full of fluids, you're all puffy. Small wonder when they try and make them stand up that they can't stand up because they've got nothing supporting them. And additionally, the damage done to the brain, particularly to memory, is shocking. With one of the doctors that were helping us with the book, Dr. Wes Ely, who's professor of medicine at Vanderbilt, earlier on he was becoming concerned that damage was being caused to his coma patients and wanted to follow them up. And one of his patients, she'd been a mathematical whiz, and she'd had an IQ of 140 prior to being placed into a coma. When she came out of her coma, and Dr. Wesley got to talk to her to see how she was getting on, she was not the same person. She couldn't even add up her checking account. So he's like, right, we're going to do some tests. We've got to do every test possible. One of the first things they did was have a sit down, take another IQ test. She scored 100. She had dropped 40 points. For someone of that intellect now to be at that level, they put it into an MRI scanner. Bearing in mind, I think she was about 35. When they looked at the scans, she had the brain of a very old woman with dementia. Parts of her brain had shriveled. Now, if you had these symptoms just generally coming out of intensive care, if you had these symptoms, they just don't even know what to say. So they're going to say something like, well, it's a temporary blip. You know, you wait till you get home, you're going to get better. If they actually put their hands up and said, really sorry here, this is a direct consequence of the treatment we have given you. This is a hospital-acquired condition, not generally covered by insurance, right? They just wouldn't want to say that. They wouldn't want you to know that. So they just simply say, it's a blip. Don't you worry. Well, dear, you had lots of drugs. You will get better. Don't you worry. And that's the end of it. But for the patient, it's not the end of it. And one of the reasons we decided to write a book or realize what we were doing with the book, we were showing other coma survivors who perhaps never spoken to anyone about their stories, just what others go through, that they are not alone, that whatever they experience is not a sign of madness. They have not got a mental illness, which they may have been diagnosed with, that what they have experienced, in many cases, people have been experiencing since the dawn of time. When a mystic goes into the deepest recesses of a cave to cut themselves off from the physical world to commune with the spirit world, the things that they are seeking, many a time, are the things coma survivors are reporting. The out-of-body experiences, the beautiful countryside and things, the meeting of entities and all these different things, these are being reported within coma. Because we live in a materialistic science world where if you can't weigh it, measure it, slice it up or whatever, it does not exist. Therefore, when a doctor cannot explain to a patient a level of consciousness they're experiencing at this very minute, they haven't got a hope of explaining the level of consciousness that people are experiencing deep within coma. They think they're unconscious. It may be that there's no such thing as unconscious, in fact, because technically these people are unconscious, and yet they're experiencing realities as real as this, even down to, tasting roast chicken that they're eating or drinking margaritas on a cruise ship, that level of feeling, or being tortured, or finding themselves trapped, for example, in an organ harvesting facility and believing that this is where they are. And oh, it's coming out of that. No one you can explain that to will take you seriously.
Right. Well, thank you for kind of heading in this general direction, because this is really where I wanted to explore some of these. I guess what I want to say is that what became very obvious in the book is that our medical system is very much grounded in materialism, a materialist worldview, and that what's going on here with these coma patients and the near-death experience is a challenge to this materialist worldview. And your comment on consciousness is perfect, because I think that there's a little bit of arrogance in medical professionals where they just kind of act as if they know what consciousness is. But the reality is, no one really knows what it is.
And I think if anybody actually wanted to really study consciousness, which is, I think, a growing science at this point in time, particularly with artificial intelligence, they would do very well to debrief coma survivors. I think for starters, people should be talking to those who've experienced near-death experiences to get a vision of what people see. For sure, people who are experimenting with DMT, which is the main component in the Amazonian mystic brew ayahuasca, and they're doing this in scientific terms, and they are finding that people are going to other realities, that these are not dreams. It is more real than anything like that. And here we have yet another doorway, as it were, into other levels of consciousness. I mean, when Nick, for example, is having his alternate life, is he having a past life? Is he actually going back to a past life and experiencing it? Others within the book have had past lives, but they told them to me as their past deaths, as in, I was a pilot, I crashed a plane into the River Thames, I drowned. I was a fisherman. I was unloading fish at a dock. There was an accident. I drowned. I was put in a box as a torture. It was filled with water. I drowned. On and on and on. And in that case, his case, almost all involved drowning in water. He also found himself in loops. One particular event after another would just loop. And this is a very, very common theme amongst coma people reporting events within coma. In his case, he had to witness his wife, not in this world, his wife dying in childbirth over and over again. that he was in the room, not like viewing it like on a movie or anything like that. He was actually there experiencing it, the smell, the feelings, the fear, everything over and over and over and over again. And this happens so often that people will talk of these loops. And in many senses, when you look at the near-death experience within coma, I mean, the classic version, I mean, you could say they've gone to heaven because in many cases that is where they appear to be going. Within coma, people will regularly use the word hell and say, this loop was my hell, and so on and so forth, that they truly believe they're trapped in hell. When they come out of this, and okay, they've had no help, no one's explained it to them, there's been no debrief. When they go to sleep at night, their dreams have somehow become much more, well, become lucid in many ways, so that they're really back there in that dream. And they don't want to sleep. They do not want to be back in that world. They would do anything to avoid that world. And therefore, they don't sleep. And that has other knock-on effects with their memory, their balance, their irritability, all sorts of other things. And they just cease to be the same person again. And the knock-on effects are just so remarkable. I mean, just take the drugs that they're pumping people full of. A very, very popular one is propofol, which is the drug that was said to have killed Michael Jackson, the King of Pop. Now, if your kidneys are not functioning because they're not going through the 24-hour cycle because that's not being regulated by the brain, this stuff is not getting flushed out of the system. And all of this stays in the system. So often when you switch somebody off, you think you've turned off the drip, as it were. They're still down there for weeks at a time because these drugs are still in their system. And when they get home, they're having withdrawal symptoms from they don't know what. Because no one's even told them. And they don't even know necessarily that these are withdrawal symptoms. They're just racked with pain and sweats and nightmares and all the rest of it. And if you talk to somebody about it, they're just so dismissed and it's heartbreaking. And when you actually get to talk to a coma survivor, their first thing is that they're enormously guarded, that they're wondering why somebody's actually got an interest in this, because nobody else has until now. And the result I've had, because I've been sharing the book with coma survivors as we've been writing it, was just thank you, somebody's listened for the first time, someone's taking me seriously. And the people that have helped us with the book, the 20 plus coma survivors, I think every single one of them has said, I'm doing this because I want others to know what I've been through and that they're not alone. And they've been telling us things that they've not even told their family, not even told their nearest and dearest. And it's only by becoming, and I can only say it's becoming friends with so many of these people over a lot of time, that they have opened up in the way they've never felt confident to open up to anybody before. And they've done so for the benefit of the reader. And they have taken us now to realms and realities that there's no Hollywood scriptwriter could ever come up with.
Right. Yeah, one of the reasons that I was interested in speaking with you and reading this book, I'm going to share just a little bit of personal information here because there were three things that popped out at me. The first two were my parents. I lost both of my parents in 2015, and my mom was in a coma. I don't think it was a medically induced coma. But when she was in the hospital, and I think she was in intensive care quite a bit, they were pumping her full of Atrovent, which is the anxiety med.
Anxiety drug.
Yeah. And you noted in the book that that can actually result in a kind of delirium. And that's exactly what the nurses and the doctors were telling me, is that my mother had terminal delirium. And
You
they
see,
automatically said, it was like, well, she's terminal, so, just let her go.
well, Nick, I'm so sorry for you anyway, and that is heartbreaking
Yeah.
because if you read the current medical literature, all the stuff that's been learned since COVID and the scale of this, right? All attempts should be made to avoid putting anybody in any form of prolonged sedation and even just this doping them up and making them,
Yeah.
just basically blurred, living in some blurred existence. What they know works, and this is like so basic that I think every nurse knows this in their heart, that a patient needs human contact. It is one of the key elements to recovery. It enables the patient to be invested in their own recovery. One of the key things when you're ill, you're in hospital, that first time when you get out of bed and you take those first few steps, you know you're on the road to recovery. When somebody's got, say, let's stick with COVID. Someone's got COVID. Yes, you've got them on a mechanical ventilator. A doctor, a nurse on hold will say that person needs to be knocked unconscious because they can't tolerate the tube. That is not true. We show it's why it's not true. We show you how to do it properly in the book. And people in the right settings are in an intensive care unit that is not mayhem, that is not all noise and panic and flashing lights and upset and people just dying and being trolleys being pushed in and out. They're in a nicer environment. They're stimulated with human contact. Their families are allowed to come in and see them. And they're kept active and they get them out of bed and moving around, gently, gently doing it. Because just a little bit of activity like that, on one level, will make them properly physically tired so they will sleep beautifully when they're in bed. It will also stop their minds drifting off to these other realities. Because what we discovered in the book is the biggest cause for delirium within a hospital is the lack of stimulation and mental, physical, and visual. We compared it to a thing known as the prisoner's cinema, where prisoners who are placed into solitary confinement, dark spaces for long periods of time, will start to get visual effects. It starts off with geometric patterns, beautiful motifs, things of this order. The longer they stay there, strange things will start to happen. They'll see animals in the room, they'll see people in the room, they'll be in other realities. This, it would appear, is what the brain is giving you something to look at almost. And this is what's happening to people with intensive care. When they've done experiments with sensory deprivation, almost everything they're reporting that people are witnessing within sensory depth are the classic symptoms of intensive care delirium. Hello, can you see the problem? And it's that simple. And a handful of doctors and nurses are trying to change the world, are trying to make people do this. But the reaction they get is, well, you can get your patients out of bed, but ours are too sick. There's no way about it. Your patients, obviously, they're fine. And they won't take it seriously. So if you've been a doctor or a nurse for decades, say, and this has been all you've ever done, and all you've ever done is for, with the best of intentions, you've never seen the damage that you're causing because critical care has become a conveyor belt of care where no one looks over their shoulder at the product coming off the other end. They do not see the damage. Therefore, they don't know there's a problem. And when anybody raises an issue, as you say earlier, because of our materialistic way of seeing things, it is not, well, you've communed with the spirit world or you were crossing over or whatever. It is, let's look in the book, oh, it's a form of mental illness. It is, in this case, hallucination, which is very, very clearly a symptom of mental illness in the book, delirium. And also, just point this out. To say if you're in a coma and you're delirious or you're hallucinating is wrong because they're both conscious states. You can't have a conscious state whilst being unconscious. And to hallucinate, mostly you have your eyes open and they're fleeting affairs. They don't last for days, weeks, years, months, decades, as in the case of Nick. So everything they want to tell you is just wrong. And they can't tell you right unless they drop the whole mantle of materialism and look outside the box. And that's the problem where we're at. But there are changes. We are moving in that direction slowly.
Well, I want to talk about some of these changes a little bit later, but I still want to stay with this idea of the consciousness. And I also just wanted to throw in that my dad was in a medically induced coma and on a ventilator. And what you wrote in the book was that people tend to become, I don't want to say addicted, but they become reliant upon that ventilator. But with the process that you mentioned, that if you don't keep them under, that doesn't necessarily have to happen. That, you
It
know,
doesn't because, well, modern ventilators, originally they were great clunky things that did the breathing for you. The modern microprocessor controlled ventilators, they allow the patient, a conscious patient, to initiate the pace of breathing. And all it is, it's just like having an electric bike or something running up a hill. It's just giving you that little spurt. And it doesn't take too long. Like in the same way, When did we last stop to think about our rate of breath? We haven't
Right.
thought about it for ages. And quickly, people get into that mode. And you just do it so gently. Yeah, you give them something to decrease in the anxiety. And then you have a loved one holding their hand and say, hey, you're doing great, and so on. And before you know it, the people are sitting upright. Because of COVID lockdown, we couldn't go to the hospitals we would have liked to have visited. So doctors and nurses were sharing with us video. So we've got video of people sitting up in bed watching a Nicolas Cage film whilst on a ventilator. We've got another one working on a laptop, running a business. And I got video sent from Brazil where COVID patients on mobile ventilators are playing volleyball in the intensive care unit. And that also helps raise the air in the unit because there's something happening. There's something kind of fun and interesting. And it just, and also just you're all in it together kind of feeling. When you walk into most intensive care units, it must be like being in a sci-fi movie where everybody's just in stasis. And there's no job satisfaction for the nurse in that. And those that have got stuck in these roles, they don't like to change. There's a horrible joke that has it that those that work in intensive care are simply just gardeners because all they ever do is tend and water the vegetables. No one ever got into nursing for that. People have got
Right.
stuck that way because that's what the hospital administrators say, you must do this. And we looked at the cost of all of this because this is the argument, you know. We haven't got the nursing staff to give the 2-to-1 patient ratios that we had pre-COVID, da da da. The longer somebody spends in intensive care, the more it costs. The longer they're on a ventilator, it costs more. If you're knocking them out, they're in there a lot longer. So the sooner they get to leave intensive care, the cheaper that is for that unit. If you can have them walk out and go home and perhaps even go back to their life quite quickly, right? There's no extra costs down the line to that healthcare facility. They're not backwards and forwards seeing the doctor. They're not trying to get treatment for PTSD. They're not trying to have their aches and pains solved and trying to get their memory back and being told they've got dementia and all the rest of it. People can actually get on with their lives. A vast number of people that come out of coma think, I'll go back to my job. And I gave the example of the maths whiz. Well, there's no way she could go back to her job. And many of the people I've spoken to have felt that they'd lost their own confidence in their abilities. And soon their employers spotted this loss of confidence and they were out of the picture. Equally, an awful lot of relationships this end because the person comes out. And okay, bearing in mind they've been in hospital, they look okay. They sort of act okay. But inside, they don't feel okay. They feel that they're like, I don't know, in the plot of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that nothing is right. Everything is glitchy. These people are not the people I knew before. I'm expected to behave this way, but I don't feel that I should behave this way. And the knock-on effects for people and the loss of finance that that results in. And the destruction of family life and homes all down the line. It's just truly remarkable.
Yeah, I wish that I had this information when my parents were in hospital. Because one of the things I learned, especially with my mother, was that what she needed was an advocate because she couldn't really advocate for herself. And so, if the families have this kind of information, they can push against this model of treatment that isn't really a treatment and is doing more damage than good. And we'll probably circle back around, but since we're here, let's talk a little bit about the alternatives. I think that the short way of thinking about it is the awake and walking, which is what you were just talking about.
I think sometime in the 1990s, there was a nurse in Salt Lake City called Polly Bailey, and she was working on an intensive care unit. All her working life, she had been taught to put people into a medically induced coma. It's the way to go, the best thing, the kindest thing. And like everybody else, she didn't get overly friendly with the patients or the family because it can lead to heartache. So you just don't do this. But she was from a small town in Utah, and a family came in. Their daughter was in a coma, and they were from the same small town. They didn't know each other, but they had so much in common. So Polly Bailey got to know these people. eventually that the young girl is discharged and she's released home. Polly goes to see her. Oh dear. Polly is horrified. She's like looking at a zombie or something. She's just not the person she ever was. And she goes back and tells her boss, "I think we're really doing some damage here." And Polly is really top nurse. She's really taken seriously. So she's tasked with thinking outside the box, trying to find another way of treating patients. So she go gathers all the medical literature, and there's nothing about weaning people off early. There's nothing at all. There's nothing about post-traumatic stress disorder. There's nothing about delirium, which is what everyone's calling these events within coma. Nothing. So she just starts to think, "I'm a nurse. What do I like to do? I do this because I like people." And they do put people on ventilators, but they bring them around as fast as they can, but gently so. And they haven't got a time to get it lost into these nightmarish worlds. And they did things like pet therapy, and they had physical therapists come in and doing all sorts of things. And they turned the ward into a really kind of nice place to be. And this started to catch on. And then they noticed that instead of releasing everybody to care homes down the line, people were actually putting their shoes and socks on and walking out of the door. And this was unheard of. So they started a new intensive care unit at this hospital, and Polly was put in charge. And other people started to see the results. And Polly then started to gather evidence. And she wrote a scientific paper, a medical paper, and published it. The first one ever. And a whole bunch of other people who've been thinking, "I really think we're doing harm here. I don't think we're doing good at all," read her paper and then started adopting her policies. And this is the way things were going. This is the 1990s. Bit by bit, bit by bit, it was becoming apparent to a lot of the really long-term skilled people from intensive care that they were seeing this damage. But then COVID struck, and then all the best practices were just thrown out of the window. And people who'd been skilled and lifelong devotees to intensive care were burning out under the sheer workload. Plus, too, that they're having ethical dilemmas because the hospital system is saying, "We can't deal with this many people. Knock them out. Put them on a vent. Knock them out." And morally, they were just like, "Oh, no, we don't want to do this." And so they were burning out. And, long story short, the suicidal feelings and, substance abuse, relationships breaking down. People left intensive care and never returned. Within the very short period of COVID happening, they built special intensive care units that never existed before. They had to fill the gaps of all the people burning out. And they brought people in from all over the hospital. The people had no idea how to run an intensive care unit. And they were just told, "Knock them out. Knock them out." And that's where we've got to now. But it's only come back to this because of COVID that there was sheer scale. It's very, very hard to say how many people. But if you think that within the Western world, if you were taken to an intensive care unit, there's an 80% chance that you would have been placed into a medically induced coma. That is an awful lot of people. And the medical literature is actually clear about this. In fact, they should make more of it, that it is obvious that more people died in COVID because they were placed into medically induced comas than should have died otherwise. If they had stuck with what is current medical procedure and was at that time, these people would not have been knocked out. They wouldn't have gone through the horror. They would have been invested in their own recovery. But people were overwhelmed, and no one's actually, you can't pin blame here on anyone as such. One nurse described it as, "We were in virgin territory with no map, and we just didn't know what to do. And we just all kind of got together on places like Facebook and WhatsApp and wherever. And so, how are you dealing with this?" And we said, people would say, "Well, we've just do what we always did with acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARD patients, which is invariably fatal, which is make them comfortable, knock them out, put them on a vent, and let's see what happens." And that's where we are today. And yet there is the medical literature, but the medical staff who are running intensive cares now, They're so knackered. They're so worn out at the end of the day. They haven't got time to read up on all the medical literature. You know, they're lucky if they can get a piece in the microwave, you know, and all the rest of it before they fall asleep on the sofa. They are worn out, and it's universal. So I can't blame anyone. There's no blame in this book at all, other than the system. And all people need to do is wake up and read the current literature.
Yeah. I find it absolutely fascinating, this idea that many of the COVID patients, what was actually killing them wasn't necessarily COVID, but the treatment.
Yeah, I know. I mean, within the book, there were doctors who've effectively put their hands up, and not necessarily COVID, but said, yeah, I have killed patients. Others said, we dread to think of the harm we have caused to patients.
Right.
And when people wake up to this, you know, it's done in the strangest ways. It's not as if, okay, some managed to read the papers that were published. Others discovered in the strangest ways. I'll give you the example of Christine Perm, who's a physical therapist working in intensive care, which is a rare thing in its own right. And she had to write up all her case notes, and her office was a real noisy, busy place. So she went down to the hospital atrium. Beautiful, it's got fountains and flowers. It's lovely, nice, comfy sofas. Sat down there and started typing up her notes. And people coming into reception were recognizing her. The families of people she'd been treating, some of the patients she'd been treating coming back for some other treatment. And she got to see what happened to people after they left intensive care, because it's never her job to find out. But she found out, and she, when she was telling me, she cried. And she said, I could write a book about this. The damage that we have collectively all caused, not just in the US, globally. We have causes, and people need to wake up, and you know, the tears in her eyes, because she knows the damage that has been caused, and only found out by sheer fluke.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking with you, what is kind of running through my mind is that I want to use this book in a introduction to philosophy class, because it addresses ethics. Because there are all these ethical questions, it addresses metaphysics in the terms of what's real. And I kind of want to circle back on that, but also epistemology in terms of our knowledge, that we are very limited in what we know about these things, you know, because we are guided by this materialistic paradigm, which is not helpful. You know, it's not helpful at all. So along these lines, before we began recording this, you had mentioned to me that before writing this book, you were firmly in the materialist camp and you had never had identified as spiritual, but now it's a little bit different.
Yeah. You see, even the term materialistic, I would have thought that would about possessions or, you
know,
want to buy a new Mercedes, so I'm materialistic, that kind of thing. I never even thought of it in these terms. That's how much of a virgin I was in this world. My background is foreign affairs, so I've sort of covered wars and disasters and things like that. And I've never really stopped to think about these things. It had been to me along the same lines of people seeing fairies in the garden or something, you know. If I stopped to think about it, which I probably never did. Within researching this book, we found ourselves investigating a highly dubious medical procedure, and we found ourselves led on a path that was purely spiritual, that took us into realms that for which there were no other explanation, because we weren't trapped in any materialistic sense. That we were investigators coming at this completely fresh, with completely open eyes. When I talk to an eyewitness from an event as a journalist, I will take that eyewitness seriously and measure it against other eyewitness accounts. And I'm doing the same thing here. People telling me that they clinically died within the hospital, they were resuscitated, they saw these things. Not one telling me, not two telling me, many telling me. So suddenly I'm getting all these eyewitness accounts that tally. Now, it occurs to me that, well, in fact, it didn't occur to me. Something happened. I'll come out and say it. My daughter died halfway through writing this book. My daughter, Rebecca, she's a police detective, completely unexpected. Worst thing could ever happen to any parent, obviously, and I had all the usual emotions that go with that. However, I knew, just knew, that she wasn't dead. I just knew she wasn't dead. She had, and suddenly I felt I had this knowledge that was giving me enormous comfort, and I'd never had anything like that before. And subsequently, a number of friends have died just of different reasons, and in each instance, yes, I'm very sad to see them go, but I think they've gone to something nicer now. Or maybe they're just coming back for another mission, because this is precisely how I see it. The writing of the, I mean, why the heck a BNI written book about coma, file it under consciousness studies? It's not my thing. I just don't do this sort of thing. And yet it was like putting together a jigsaw puzzle and having somebody handing me all the right pieces at the right time. I mean, in lieu of a better word, the word I was using repeatedly was freaky. This is so freaky that this is happening. It's so freaky that I met this person just when I needed that question answering, who then introduced me to this other person that, and everything just fell together so perfectly. On one level, it's the easiest thing I've ever done in my life, just because it flowed so. And the way the book's told, it's written as we're investigating, so it's a bit like a journey of exploration. As I'm learning, you're learning. And my daughter Rebecca dying halfway through this, I realized my entire outlook had changed, that I now believed in spirit realms and all the rest of it. And we had done a lot of exploration, things you can do. Okay, so we took psilocybin, for example, because we wanted to experience certain things people would tell us, such as the all-pervading energy that exists around us, and people within coma regularly saying this, people with DMT, people in near-death experiences. We had to experience some of this the best we could. So we found magic mushrooms locally. Oh yeah, well, yeah, 100%. I am experiencing what people are telling me, and the energy that people talk about. This is obvious. It's just so abundantly self-obvious that now I've seen it. I can't unsee it. I can't unknow now what I know. And I firmly believe that. And at some point soon after Rebecca died, I mean, I wasn't writing for a bit. And I think I had a near-death experience while sleeping, in that I found myself in a tractor beam of powerful light. And the thing I knew about it, in the same way that the energy was abundantly self-obvious, this place was abundantly self-obvious. I knew precisely where I was. I had been here a lot of times before. I had the sense that, yeah, in the past, I was very happy to be here. Thank you. And this instance, I'm not, because if I've got a mission, and this again would seem nuts from the pre-book me, if I had a mission in life, it would be to actually research and write this book and get the story told. And you can't take me now, that would just be silly, wouldn't it? And the next thing I know, I'm looking out of my window. And the next day, I start writing the book again. But I take a completely different angle. I didn't pick up where I left off. I decided to go in a completely different angle. And that changed the whole nature of the book. And I met this wonderful nurse practitioner called Kaylee Dayton, who opened my eyes to the damage that is being caused to patients, and her immense bravery in trying to change the world. Just recently, she's had people trying to take her license away because she hasn't been knocking people's senses with medication. She got out of that one because no one's got any evidence to say, yes, we should knock them around. So odd the way just things have happened with the telling of this book. Getting a publisher, right? It'd be much easier for me to go to a local store, buy a lottery ticket, and get a jackpot than it is to get a top publisher. In this day and age, it's almost impossible. And particularly for a subject like coma. So you've got a book, and they want to see what other books have been written in this market before, right? To see how your one might work. There isn't anyone. There isn't any books on this subject whatsoever. Jeff Kripal, wonderful guy who wrote the preface for the book, he'd been helping throughout the book with chatting about how things are going, etc., at different times. And I happened to say to him, I've just written the last words in the book. And Jeff says, would you mind if I mentioned it to my publisher? And I think, well, would I mind? Let me think about that. He mentioned the publisher. Within 2 hours, we had the workings for a book deal. Now, that doesn't happen. None of this should happen the way this happened. It's just too remarkably easy. So I'm just looking at it that this is my mission. This is my wife and I's mission. And we're very pleased with the job that we have done because I think, as far as what's known in the world today, this can't be improved upon. I'm just saying this in the journalistic editor's kind of perspective, that we have written and investigated a subject that affects us all that no one has investigated before. It's just mental. It's impossible to believe that. And yet that's what's happened. And I don't know what we're going to say about that.
Well, when we spoke prior, I actually thought about Jeff Kripal because the word you used to describe this change
The
was he
flip.
flipped. Yeah. And
Yeah.
that's
Well,
the
I read
title of one of
Jeff's
his
book.
books.
I read his book and I go, I know that feeling. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that, having the conversations that I have on this podcast and the readings that I've done outside of this, that there is an ongoing challenge to the Western materialistic worldview. And again, that materialistic doesn't mean like what you initially thought, of shallow getting things, but that there's just matter. It's all just matter in motion, and that if it can't be weighed or measured, it's senseless. But it's coming from all these different perspectives and all of these different areas. And I found your work, touched on so many of them, and it had a real application to why this is so important. And it's so important because people are suffering.
I mean, the meaning of life for most people, the meaning of life is what it is. We live, we die, full stop. Therefore, let's go fully materialistic, gather as much wealth, have as much fun or whatever as we can in this time, and that's the end of it. Given that I have flipped and I now believe that this is one mission of many, and I will no doubt come back, although I'm a bit worn out, I wouldn't mind a break. If that is the case, where I'm almost losing my train of thought here because it's just ask me the question again, Nick.
Oh, well, I don't know if I actually asked a specific question
Okay.
as much as I was making a comment, but it was just this idea. And you do this in the book where because you start with the experiences that people are having in these medically induced comas, and then it shifts to consciousness. And so you have the near-death experiences, for example, and the medical response to that is, well, it's just the brain kind of closing down on itself, and that's why people see this tunnel of light, and there's nothing to it other than that. But yet people are having these out-of-body experiences that they are getting information that they should not be getting when their brain is flatlining. You mention a little bit of some of the reincarnation studies that have been done, especially Ian Stevenson. And so you have from all these disparate areas or different areas of people saying, this materialist paradigm, there's something that's not quite right with it. And the way that I've always expressed this, and I have mentioned this many, many times in the podcast, is, and I'm basing this on the work of Thomas Kuhn, The Structures of Scientific Revolutions, that, science operates on a paradigm. And what Kuhn always, what he wrote was that what creates a new paradigm is an anomaly, something that the paradigm cannot answer. And I've been saying for a long time, that's consciousness, that the materialist paradigm cannot account for consciousness. And I think all too often it's viewed as, well, that's just, like some philosophical thought and things like that, But it is so important, and this is where I ended the comment, was because, and this is what your book demonstrates, is that the paradigm that we have has to change. Consciousness is the driver, and it has to change because people are suffering.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to be scientists or
Right.
doctors that are going to make this change. I think it's others now. I think particularly computer engineers, people seeking people, when they're looking to understand artificial intelligence and wondering where they can take it, can they get it to create its own consciousness, for example? In order to get to anything close to that point, you need to start understanding our own. There's nothing. There's philosophy and all the rest of it, but there's, you know, philosophical stuff, but there is nothing in the scientific papers. They have to now look elsewhere. Yeah. And I think they are. When you add on top of that, that, okay, I wasn't even remotely spiritual. And when I start telling people about the project and then we're moving into spiritual zones, people are not giving me funny looks. People are saying, yeah, okay, I've always thought that, and so on and so forth. So I think people have always suspected this sort of thing, and yet it's coming to the surface more now. I couldn't say what the drivers are, but I imagine they're multiple. You know, the endless bloody wars, the climate stuff, whatever. The lack of meaning in life, the nihilistic feeling about so much of our existence, that there has to be more for it than that. And when you look on, so just say Facebook, at groups devoted to the near-death experience, we're into tens and tens and tens of thousands of people all looking for answers. And I think we are reaching a point where this is changing. Within the medical world, there's no spirituality being taught, but they're finding through the trials of, you know, prayer class, prayer groups and whatever within hospitals, that it's helping people emotionally and spiritually and all the rest of it. And just gradually, you know, it's not a tsunami of any kind. It's a very slow trickle, but it's all starting to gel at this point. And we were noticing this as we were putting the book together, and it just seemed to reinforce everything that we were discovering ourselves. And this is also too appears to be wide ranging, that we go off into these other realms and so on, but everything is all tied and we all keep coming back to the same points. And I just see how everything is connected. Yeah. You know, once you've seen it, as I believe I did with the near-death experience, and just by talking to people who I actually really trust and count as friends now, that I just know there's more. Yeah. That there's no way they're making this up. And some people, I've asked all sorts of people. There's Professor Elizabeth Loftus, who's an expert in false memory in court cases. So I gave her some coma survivor stories, and she couldn't think that people were making them up as such, but she implied they were just dreams. And when I said they're a bit more detailed than dreams, she did say a lot of people do spend a long time rehearsing their stories. Well, I don't get that sense from any of the people in this book that have been telling me their accounts. In many cases, most of them were not gagging to get their story out. It was like blood from a stone in some instances. It took months for people to tell me things. These are not people who are looking for attention or anything like that. In fact, just the precise opposite. And they're not getting any attention at all. We do feel that the book's going to help them enormously. And also, you know, your mum and dad, it was a horribly upsetting event that happened to you. That this would have happened to so many people in the time of COVID.
Yeah.
That to know someone who's placed into a medically induced coma, yeah, okay, a lot of it is dark. But I think it's a bit like a DMT journey or an ayahuasca journey, that it can begin very, very dark. If you're prepped for that journey, you know how to handle it. And then it moves on. I think a lot of people in coma pass through those stages. And many who've told me really nightmarish events and then go on to tell me some of the most beautiful NDE accounts I've ever heard in my life. So I would say to anyone who lost someone in a coma that at the end they had the most beautiful, beautiful experience. And I just know it. And, you know, if we had a time machine, you could play this back to me, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I'd go, that's not me. Someone's taken over me. Yeah, but no, 100% not. I believe that.
Yeah. Two things that came to mind when you were speaking. One is, and this is just more of a comment, I suppose, but my background is, you know, I have some philosophy background, but my passion is religious studies. And I teach religious studies, at least I used to. And a lot of my students would be nursing students because they were required to take a religious studies course. But
no way.
Yeah. But the reason that they were required, I think, to take a religious studies course was to better understand the faith traditions of patients and their families and to be respectful of that. What it doesn't do, what it didn't do is bring in the larger question of spirituality to medicine. And so now I'm like a little bit on fire because of that comment that you made and that connection I made. But the other thing is the perspective, like you talked to the person who talked about, you know, false memories. One of the responses is, you know, well, it's just the drugs.
Yeah, right. Okay.
You know, it's just
okay. Where can I buy these drugs? Where can I buy a drug that will give me an alternate life spanning decades when I just take a 2 week vacation in this world? Yeah. Because there aren't any that can do that. Okay, there are certain things you can take that will give you a near death experience, but it's a little bit touch and go because you might actually go a little bit further than you were anticipating. Mm. So for sure, there are ways and means of doing that, but not giving someone an alternate life that spans decades. Yeah. There's nothing that does that. And, you know, there are clearly similarities between events within coma and those within certain psychedelic substances. Patently, that's happening. A key element of the brain is switching off the default mode network, and that controls our conscious reality. This is clearly happening with ayahuasca, with mescaline, with all sorts of things, LSD, psilocybin. It has been demonstrated that it switches off within coma, which is leading to an expansion of consciousness. Coma, it's not like a one-size-fits-all thing. It's different things to different people. Some people, let's supposing someone who was carrying a lot of weight, who had a history of recreational drug use, would be a lot harder to knock out than a little old lady with dementia who would take a tiny amount to knock out, to send to the deepest depths of coma. Therefore, some people are just bubbling beneath the surface and others are as close to death as you can get. Outside of head injuries when they need to look inside, somebody who's in a medically induced coma does not generally get put into an MRI scanner or have their brain scans read. And when a doctor, Dr. Wesley the Vanderbilt, did it when he was becoming suspicious, he was horrified just how low he was sending people. He was saying, you know, it's a single flat line on this EEG reader. It is like looking at a heart without a pulse. We are pushing people so much deeper than we ever possibly imagined. And they are teetering on this life and the next. And in a measurable sense, they really, really are. And therefore, chemicals that are in the system, such as naturally occurring psychedelic chemical in the human, DMT, which may be in all mammals, will appear to be released at key moments of stress and impending death and death. Ethically, you can't experiment on healthy individuals and try and find the source for, you know, the DMT production at the pineal gland, for example. So they do it on animal models in the laboratory. When they've given rats induced heart attacks, they've seen their DMT levels spike like 600% or thereabouts. Comparatively speaking, if we were to take that amount of DMT, we would be well away, you know, with Mother Ayahuasca, you know, we'd be in complete other realms. And it would appear that that is what's happening. Just you can't measure it because of ethical reasons. That would appear to be what's happening when people experience a near-death experience. Not to deride the experience in any sense, but to simply say that these chemicals are like a key in a door. They're just opening a doorway that's always there. And when you take, you know, psychedelics, people are just saying that's a shortcut. You know, there are other ways to do this, by meditation, by dark retreats, by all sorts of other ways of doing it. But people are having clearly these experiences, and they are as spiritual as you can get. And for a doctor to turn around, I was on a phone-in show a few weeks ago, and a coma patient called him, and he'd had a really beautiful near-death experience, very unusual one. And I said, did you mention this to the doctors? And he said, yeah, I was told I had a very active imagination. Mm. And that's it. That's it. Now, Okay, let's put aside for the moment that you shouldn't really be placing people into medically induced comas outside of a handful of instances. Just supposing that wasn't the case. You should have coma survivors talking to people before you put them into a coma and saying, look, these things can happen to you. Don't worry about it. They are understood now. And that we're going to have a chat when you come out the other end. We'll have a debrief in the way that we would debrief, say, a soldier coming back from Afghanistan or somewhere. We'll have a proper debrief. That would make a world of difference. As one person said to me, you go into a coma, no one hands you a pamphlet, explaining all the things that are going to happen to you, and you're just dismissed at the other end. But another coma survivor, or just meet other coma survivors in any setting, be it physical or digital, and to share your experiences, like a weight lifted off their shoulders. And then when people get a chance to discuss the near-death type experiences, rather than just the sheer horror ones, they get a sense that there is so much more out there, that our lives do have meaning. And so many people, like people who've experienced the near-death experience in the regular world, many of them have experienced them within coma, the nicer ones, do not fear death. Absolutely do not fear death at all. Those that found themselves in hell and were maybe drawn out of their coma before they could move into these other realms, they do fear death and they do not want to go to sleep and they do not want to die. And they're just left with that. And it's a horrible way to be in life because now, having taken comfort from what I've discovered writing the book, that I didn't write a book with this in mind, everything that gave me my particular flip that came, is in the book as part of the story. I think people are waking up to that. And if people within coma could see that they are part of something that people have been seeking since the dawn of time, and you happen just sadly to be living in a world now where you are treated with derision, and skepticism and told you're mentally unwell or away with the fairies. That's your misfortune to be doing that now. Because at another time, you may have been canonized as a saint for the things you saw.
I you know, it's the model that you describe in the book is kind of the model that I hold, and it's the brain is it acts almost like a receiver or a filter, and it's fascinating because I always assumed that if someone were to take like a psychedelic, their brain would be on fire, it'd light up all these things, but it's just the opposite. It kind of closes down a little bit to let more information in. And I think it's really important. I like this idea of preparing people for this because I wonder if, and I think you mentioned this in the book, that people who have near-death experiences without being in a coma, it's very rare for them to experience a have a hellish kind of experience. But the people within the medically induced coma, it's a much larger percentage of them having that kind of hellish experience. And I just wonder if we better prepared people for what may be coming, if that would reduce then the percentage of those hellish experiences.
It's actually easier not to knock them out in the first place. Keep
True.
them active. Keep them active. Having their family come in, bringing the dog in, I mean, whatever. And suddenly everything changes and you don't need to go down this path. That's just why I said a few minutes ago that if you're going to have to put someone in a coma, have someone chat to them before and after. There will be cases, someone's having heart surgery, let's say, we know with your particular case that you may have problems, so we may have to put you on an ECMO machine, da 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 da. We will have to put you into a state of suspended animation. We like to explain to you some of the things that people experience. And let me introduce you to so and so who's been through this herself. Whoomph. What a difference that would make to people. But you could apply that to so much in medicine anyway, right? But certainly within this case, you could do that. And even if you can't, you can't go back in time and prevent it, happening in the past, you can start slowing it down now so that it will stop happening. You could recall so many coma survivors and simply say, in the light of what we've discovered, and It's all provable. Everything we're saying in the book is backed up by medical and scientific literature or eyewitness accounts.
Right.
Everything we have learned, right, should now be taken into consideration into critical care. It is not, it is not too much to ask. It is not more expensive. We demonstrate that it is not more expensive. We demonstrate that ultimately this is what doctors and nurses joined the profession for.
Right.
And it just follows that just human interaction, just think of it. Any image of somebody, cast, put an image in your mind of a person in the hospital, receiving care. They're having a nurse or somebody, being kind to them, holding a hand, stroking their brow. That's why people become doctors and nurses. And they hate this situation. They hate the
Yeah.
situation that they find themselves in. So it all needs changing. It all needs to change.
Yeah.
But as it's pointed out to me, I think something like only 14% of new procedures actually become accepted. And if you look at some things such as bloodletting, draining the blood from those at death's door to balance their humours. Well, we did that for 2,000 years, more or less, and that finally came to a stop, at least I'm hoping.
Yeah.
And one day this will come to a stop after hopefully 50 years. And I think one day someone hopefully will walk into a secondhand bookstore, find my book, Coma and Near-Death Experience, and go, oh, how primitive. They used to do that then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'd like.
Yeah.
So I don't want people to wait 50 years.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you can answer this or not, but I'm thinking from the perspective of someone who is a family member or loved one of someone who's in the hospital, and they want to put them into medically induced coma, and they've read your book. And
Yeah.
I wonder, can they say, no, don't do this?
No, no.
Are they at the mercy of the
Seemingly not,
system?
no, because we live in a world, first off, where doctors know best. And, whoever you talk to says, is the doctor recommending this? Well, he's a doctor, she's a doctor. What, you've got to do what they say. I said this earlier, I'm thinking. Ask for evidence. Just say, yeah, okay, we're up for this. Just show me how this works. And not just some nonsense that you're going to get this great sleep. Let me just talk you through it. Just show me something that says it works. Because they can't. They just simply cannot. Never, ever let it happen to you outside of these three cases, brain seizure, certain wounds, heart operations. Beyond that, never let it happen to you. Simple. Here's a simple thing. So, heart bypass operations, very common in the Western world. You're on the operating theater table for 4 to 6 hours, completely knocked out. What they don't like to talk about is the cognitive damage that people suffer from just 4 to 6 hours. You'll notice more and more doctors are not so keen to give people general anesthetics. They'd rather try and get things done on a local. More and more people are reporting brain misfunction following it. There have been studies, some of which are mentioned in the book, that there is just this cognitive damage that they're never the same again. And often because these operations take place later in life, if someone comes out of it and they're like, can't remember their children's names, 2 months later. Well, that's early onset dementia. That's it. Sorry, pal. That was your problem. Nothing to do with the hospital, by the way. Not a hospital acquired condition. So no one wants to talk about it. But it's there the whole way through. But if they can wake up and they can reduce the number of people spending time unconscious on an operating theatre table, they can wake up to that. They can certainly wake up to the fact that the same drugs which are causing that much damage in 6 hours are going to cause immense damage in 6 weeks or 3 months or what. They need to wake up to that. And it's kind of obvious.
Well, that was my third thing. My aunt had surgery on her neck, and it was after that that she was diagnosed with dementia. And I pointed this out to my uncle. I'm like, her memory had been slipping a little bit before then, but I saw a noticeable difference after that surgery. And he
In
just.
the book, we've got a nurse, Jill Larkin Storer. She spent years as a heart surgery nurse. Both her parents went through bypass procedures. She says no one wants to talk about it. They all know the damage. They all know the damage. And she had to move on to something else in time. They are aware. So it's not a great quantum leap to go, short levels of sedation, long levels of sedation, would there also be a problem? Well, obviously. It's just a case of waking people up. So if you've been doing this for years and years and years, I think I was starting to say this earlier, you're less likely to change. If you're entering the profession now, you're going to be reading the newest literature. It just stands to reason. For some reason, things like ICU delirium are not taught in medical schools. The whole notion of prolonged deep sedation is not taught within schools. It's shown that we need to do it for this or that, not outside of that. All of this will change as more and more people come into the profession. I find this really edifying that since COVID, certainly in the US and possibly in the UK too, more people are signing up to be doctors and nurses than ever before. You think it would be the opposite. I find that just warms my heart so wonderfully. And, intensive care for so many doctors and nurses, it's like the special forces, it's the sharp pointy end of medicine. And it attracts a lot of people. Well, there's an awful lot of reading to do since COVID that will really bring you up to speed. And already, I mentioned Jill Larkin-Storer. She trains now nurses for critical care in Maryland. And she's put the book on their curriculum so they can see what happens to people with inside coma, can also see people who are not in coma when they're not getting any stimulus within intensive care, how they start going a little bit doolally, seeing kangaroos in the room and all sorts of other things. They can just see what causes that and immediately how to stop that happening. Get them up, walk them about, talk to them about their children, anything. Just involve them in something and that will pass. These new doctors and nurses coming in will pick this up. And eventually you'll get to a point where they're in the majority. But no one's going to read this book and say, hold on, guys, right, from here on, we stop this practice at this hospital or whatever. It won't happen that way. But it will gradually happen and it will stop. And it's like anything. If something's shown to work and shown to have beneficial effects, people will be attracted to that. People will find out about that by various means, not just up, but all sorts of things. And that's ultimately what will bring about the change. But just left to the doctors and nurses who are too busy to see the damage they're causing, that change won't come about. And I think, because of COVID, because a private eye and a journo had very little to do, and that we investigated something that looked a little bit fishy, we've discovered something that no one was going to tell you. And we've shown how doctors have been fobbing you off for years. And now you have an explanation for what you're suffering from if you've survived a coma. If you've lost someone in a coma, you'll be able to put it in the perspective of did they need to be there in the first place? And if they didn't come out of that coma, quite likely what they've been through towards the end and how wonderfully beautiful that was. And, people who've helped us with the book and have want, okay, the Danny Paint, who's doing the voice for the audiobook. Her husband just died just before she started recording. She felt that the book had helped her bring peace to her life. That in the same way that I flipped, and I now know we don't die, my daughter did not die per se. She felt a comfort that she hasn't been able to find from any other source. And she's been looking. She's actually quite a well-known actress in South Africa. So doors are open to her, religious, spiritual leaders. And she said the book helped her more than any of them. So I'm really heartened by that. And I mean, this is why we're doing it. We want, as a journalist, don't do this for money. As a journalist, I want to share information. And where possible, I want to help people. We know that if we contribute to this medical procedure coming to a halt, we have helped save in future millions of lives, not just in death, in terms of death, but in terms of shadows of half lives, that people just say you've got Alzheimer's and, don't worry about it, you'll get better or whatever, or this is the way it goes. Just dismissing people. Not necessary now, and if you've been in a coma, you're listening to this. And you can't get your friends or family to understand, or you don't even have the first clue how to tell them, get them to read the book. And the book will do the explaining for you. And I mean, Nick, you're very, very good. You've actually read the book. And you said lovely things. Thank you so much.
Of course. I was looking forward to reading the book, and like I said, I found it very fascinating, but also unnerving. But it's hopeful. I think, like you said, that it gives people this knowledge that there is something more. And it's just tells me that we just have work to do within the medical system.
I'm thinking this is just the start. I think that we've, in a sense, opened a doorway that people haven't even peered through before. And now that it's time for other people to take this on. There's no way we're doing another one. No way we're doing coma near-death experience two. That's not going to happen. But is there is now ample opportunity and evidence presented very clearly in the book for others to take this further. And there's so much that we can learn, both in consciousness studies and in the care of patients.
Absolutely. Well, it's on the forefront of a new paradigm, and hopefully it's going to usher us through that door or help usher us through that door. And I know in the back of the book that you give resources for people where they can go, like if they've had coma or if they're family members, things like that.
Yeah, we thought, I mean, that's vitally important. I mean, the whole thing about sharing information is to make sure people can find all the information that they need. So we can easily put, you'll see at the back of the book, we list every Facebook group that we think will help, for example. The medical and scientific literature, we just list it at the back of the book. It's all kind of indexed, but there's 20 pages of that that stand up everything that we say in the book. And mostly we're not really saying anything. We're having other people tell their stories and they're saying things. We're doing a kind of, I think, pure journalism job on this. We're letting other people tell their stories and we are presenting the evidence. And you can see exactly where the evidence is if you want to go and follow that up and read that entire paper from beginning to end and so on. So yeah, it's all there. It's all in there.
Now, typically, I know that we're about out of time here. Now, typically, I always end by asking two questions. And I don't know if these questions are necessarily appropriate because one, I always ask, well, what do you got coming up next? Which is okay. But the other one is, I always ask if there is a place where people can go to find out more about you and the work. So I don't know if you want to share that or a resource for people to go to.
I really hate it when you read a book or something, or you read an article, and you can't get in touch with the writer or the journalist. It really, really annoys me. I'm a journalist. People with stories to tell are the lifeblood of my profession. So, yeah. You can most definitely contact me. If you write to me, I will guarantee I will write back thoughtfully, may not be immediately, but I will most definitely do that. Easiest way to find me is to type the name of the book into a search engine. I have my website, which is my name, Alan, Alan Pearce, Pearce, AlanPearce.com. And on there, you'll see a way of contacting me. And I will be in touch. I'm not big on social media. I used to teach people not to use social media because it's unsafe. And B, as a private investigator, would use social media to track people down. So we don't use social media too much, but you can certainly contact us by email.
Okay, perfect. Well, I'll put a link into the your website and also for the book as well. I always do that. I'll put it directly from the publisher, and then I usually do bookshop.org because that's a nice collective of independent book owners, bookshop owners,
Good. Important.
rather than Amazon. Jeff Bezos is rich
No,
enough.
absolutely. Everybody support their local bricks and mortar bookstore. It is vitally important. When it's gone, it's gone.
For sure, for sure. Well, Alan, thank you so much for your time today. This was a very enlightening conversation, and I am so grateful to have had the opportunity to speak with you.
It's been an absolute joy. I mean, a real joy. And thank you just so much for reading the book. I mean, it's wonderful courtesy. Not everyone gets this opportunity all the time or whatever. So I'm really thrilled. And we got to discuss the book properly. Really, really lovely day today. Thank you so much.
Right. Well, thank you. And that's a wrap on episode 133 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. If you like what I do here on Rebel Spirit Radio and would like to support my work, and please support my work, then consider becoming a patron. You can find the link for the Patreon in the show notes or video description.
There are a number of perks for patrons, including early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, the Rebel Spirit Radio Book Club, and so much more. And of course, if you'd prefer to make a one-time donation, you can still do so via PayPal. I will be incredibly grateful for any support that you can provide. Another way that you can help the podcast is to share it with friends, family members, coworkers, even anyone that you think will enjoy it, and share it on social media too. That really is one of the best ways you can help and support the podcast. Help me grow my audience. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me share the good news. Also, if you enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to give it a positive rating on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. And please subscribe. For those viewing on YouTube, please make sure to give this video a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. And also hit that notification bell so you'll be notified whenever I upload new content. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.